Committee on Budget for Tuesday, May 31st, 2005, and open a work session on 5526, the Department of Higher Education Capital Construction. The intent here today is simply to get an overview. No action will be taken. If Mr. Bender feels it's necessary to get an answer from the audience, we'll go to the audience. But the general purpose today is just to keep the committee abreast of capital construction issues. I'm hoping that someday we might get clearance to act on capital construction before the end of this session. So with that, Mr. Bender, do you want to start through the overview?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have prepared an overview for you of the capital construction request of the Department of Higher Education and also some information on how the state funds capital construction projects in higher education and the impacts of decisions that you make on the state budget. So if I may, one other thing that I do want to point out also as much for the people in attendance as well as for you is that the chair of the Senate Budget Committee has decided that he would like to have two separate bills for capital construction at higher ed and for capital construction at community colleges. The reason why I mention this is that these two community college proposals were contained in a single bill as introduced by the governor to Ways and Means. But he will be separating that out into two bills, and 5526 will just be higher ed OUS capital construction projects. I've distributed a handout to you, and everything that I'd like to cover with you is contained in this single handout. So hopefully this will be easy to follow. And what I started off with in this handout is just to talk about basically the types of funds that we use in order to construct new facilities at the Oregon University System and in order to repair and upgrade the existing facilities there. And there are a number of fund sources that are used in this process, and if I just can briefly discuss what those are. One of the fund sources that is used is general fund itself. And the governor's recommended budget proposes about $17 million in general fund for the capital construction budgets. The general fund primarily has been used in recent biennia as a source of funds for deferred maintenance, to address deferred maintenance and capital repair issues. As you may recall from the presentation that the department provided to you in phases 1 and 2 back in the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, the department has a very large backlog of deferred maintenance. And deferred maintenance is defined to be the estimate of the cost of essentially bringing the facilities that they have back to a ideal condition is the proper term, but basically to fix the problems that have accumulated in the facilities over time. And that, I believe, is estimated at about $600 million at this point in order to do that. What the state has been doing is providing some general fund to help address that and matching that general fund with Article 11G bonds to provide twice that dollar amount that the institutions can use each biennium to address those issues. In the governor's budget, there is about $11.8 million in general fund and $11.8 million in Article 11G bonds that are combined and used for that purpose. There's also in the governor's budget a general fund support of one new capital project. So in addition to repairing the existing facilities, one new project is supported by general fund in the governor's recommended budget. And that is a portion of the costs of constructing a new facility in Medford that would be used by Southern Oregon University in a joint facility that would also be used by Rogue Community College. There is an amount of general fund in there, and that amount that the governor had placed in his budget for that facility was $5.4 million. To the best of my knowledge, the only decision that the House or Senate co-chair have made that they've let me know about relating to the capital construction, their capital construction proposals, is that in neither of those budgets do they include the $5.4 million in general fund for the Southern Oregon University facility in Medford. But I'm not aware of any other decisions that have been made regarding the approval of any of the projects that we're talking about or the non-approval of any of them or other funding decisions, except that there will not be general fund, in their budget at least, available for that, a portion of that facility's costs.
Clarification, yes. Mr. Chair. Mr. Bender, was the 5.4 included in 11.8 governor's budget?
It was an addition to
in
that.
In addition?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
The second source of funds for capital construction projects in higher ed are the Article 11G bonds, which get their name from the article of the state constitution that authorizes their issuance. Article 11G bonds have a number of features that are important, and I think I've highlighted both of the most important features about Article 11G bonds, so you can see those quickly. The first is that the bonds must be matched by a dollar-for-dollar general fund appropriation. So in other words, if you want to issue $10 million in bonds for a project to help finance it, there has to be at least $10 million of general fund to match that. Now, general fund, however, does not necessarily have to be what we think of as general fund, because what the state has been doing for, I don't know when this started, but it's been, you know, over 10 years now at least, what the state has been doing is allowing the institutions to raise funds from donations or from grants or even from other government sources and use those funds as the general fund match that's required in the state constitution. I mean, the match is required in the Constitution, so it cannot be, it's an absolute necessity. But in each capital construction bill, and the bill that came before you from the governor continues this provision, there are laws that allow these donations to be contributed or placed in the general fund. So then they can be turned around and again used and meet the general fund match requirements. And that's what the state has typically been doing in recent biennia since Measure 5.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Neal.
On those issues, Steve, the University of Oregon, there's the... Is it Gilbert Hall? Is that
yes.
The theater complex, the new education building? Those are all that. In Oregon State, it's student housing, and then there's one, the new steam plant, 43. Those are other funds. Those would be dedicated to general funding.
Right. There would have to be, for each of those projects, there would have to be an amount equal to the Article 11G amount that would be allowed to be entered into the general fund and to become the legal match.
Are those funds now raised? I mean, do we know if they're raised or not?
In some cases, they are raised. In some cases, they are not raised yet. And the institutions continue to seek the necessary donations.
The University of Oregon, Mr. Chair, has done an excellent job, as I outlined in my memo.
My understanding with the University of Oregon is the two smaller projects have all of the match funds in place, and that the larger project, the education building, may in the very foreseeable future have all of the dollars in place.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Question or comment from Mr. Bender. I think that what you describe here is sort of a slide toward giving the wealthier districts the advantage, because some of the less wealthy districts have trouble coming up with those matching funds, or the wealthier, less wealthy universities, less wealthy institutions. And so those that have tend to get more under this scenario, and those that have less tend to remain that way or get even less, because they're unable to play that game instead of having general funds actually allocated, the general funds have to be generated by the district And if they're unable to do that, they don't get to play.
I think their history would show your concerns to be well-founded in looking at the projects that have been able to go forward by raising donations as the general fund match. It is clearly easier for the institutions with a larger donor base to do that.
I think there has been, Senator Whitsitt, there has been some discussion. Obviously, no legislation has been introduced. That for the three large universities to retain the existing match requirements, but that for the regionals, perhaps the match requirements should be reduced to something that's more reasonable with their true capabilities to raise funds locally, like reducing it either to a third match or to a one-quarter match. That would probably put them on a more fair playing field with the three large universities. So. But that, of course, would have to be a constitutional measure approved by the submitted by the legislature and approved. It could be done by referendum. It could be done by initiative, too, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Mr. Chair, you have mentioned that before. Is there a bill?
There's not.
Well, we can create one, though. That's easy enough.
Any, Senator Walker, any one of us can create but still has a bill left. That they can introduce can create that. Whether or not you can pass it through both chambers and pass it with the, you know, with the public is probably another question.
I think that's we need to give the voters an opportunity to make that decision.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. This is for the good of the order. Having conducted a lot of hearings in this room, I'm going to suggest that we all move our microphones close to where we're sitting. Complaints all the time from the public that they cannot hear the discussions going on in this room unless we're actually speaking into the microphone. So.
Okay. Mr. Bender.
The next revenue source that has been used beginning in the 2001 biennium, this was not used prior to that, are lottery bonds. Lottery bonds are bonds the debt service is paid by the lottery. In comparison to Article 11G bonds, there are two important things to note. Well, one thing I didn't mention about the Article 11G bonds is that we pay the debt service from the general fund. But the ways that lottery bonds differ from Article 11G bonds are, first of all, there is no required match. So theoretically, a project could be entirely funded. All of its costs could be funded by lottery bonds if you chose to do that. The other thing to note is that lottery bonds will have a higher debt service cost to the state than an equal amount of Article 11G bonds because they are not general obligation bonds and they are typically issued for only a 20-year term instead of a 30-year term. That means that the debt service that comes, that is generated is higher per biennium than Article 11G bonds. The next type of bonds are Article 11F1 bonds. I'm going to be talking the least about the Article 11F1 bonds today. These are bonds that can be issued for what the Constitution describes as self-liquidating and self-supporting facilities in higher education. What this means is that the facilities that are being financed needs to be an identified revenue source that can generate funds to pay that debt service. And the debt service is then paid, thank you, out of the university's budgets and not out of the general fund. Mostly, these are used to finance auxiliary projects, such as housing and dining projects, where the funds would come from housing and dining fees. Another subset of the Article 11 F1 bonds are the student building fee projects. The student building fee is a part of the tuition that students pay, and the money that's generated from that fee is used to create revenue to pay off the debt service on Article 11 F1 bonds that are used to construct facilities such as student centers or other facilities that can be financed by the student building fee. on page two, the next page here, other revenues, there are significant amounts of gifts, grants, capital reserves, federal and local government revenues that are all used to help support the capital construction projects. And then there are some proposals for some new funding sources this biennium that haven't been used in this budget before, even though both of these mechanisms exist. But I'd like to just cover that as we go along, if that's okay.
Yes.
One question is, when you're talking about the cost of servicing these loans, I understand the difference in term. Actually, it costs more to repay a 30-year loan than it does a 20-year loan, but it costs more per year.
Yes.
But from the standpoint of interest rates, are the interest rates on the 11G of the lottery and the 11F bonds pretty similar?
I believe that the interest rates on the 11Gs and the 11F ones are pretty much the same because they're both general obligations. Even though the Article 11F1 bonds are financed from the university budgets, they are sold and legally are general obligations of the state, so they get the lowest possible interest rate that would be available for the state to borrow. The lottery is a higher interest rate. It's not considered a general obligation of the state, and I can check to find out like a recent differential, but it is higher than the other two.
Thank you.
If I may ask you to look here at the first chart in this packet. So it would be the page after, it's actually the third page here. This shows a history of recent proposals of what has been financed in total in the Department of Higher Education's capital construction budget. Goes back to 1909-01, and one of the things you might notice that really stick out is that I don't have sums for any of these biennia at the top of these bars. I can certainly give you those numbers right away if you want to know so you don't have to add the components up yourself. But I didn't put a sum in on purpose because I think in this particular case, really looking at the individual components is a little more helpful than looking at the totals to see what's going on here. Because there are two, for each biennium, we have two numbers that are in shades of blue and one number which is in a shade of yellow. The yellow represents the expenditures that are not being financed from the state general fund or lottery budget. So these are either the Article 11 F1 bonds that we were talking about or the gifts, the grants, contracts, all of these things. The amount in yellow shows what the expenditures in the budgets have been for these from these sources. Our main concern as your staff when looking at the proposals that are being financed by the, you know, not by the state general fund or lottery fund, we do have a concern about those projects, and our main concerns are to see whether the universities do appear to have sufficient resources available in order to meet their obligations that they will accrue once they have these facilities in place. So this could include debt service if they're bonding or operations costs or what have you, even if they're not bonding. So even if something's 100% gift financed, we look at that, and as the state legislature, you must approve a project even if it's 100% gift financed, because this then becomes the property of the state. And as your fiduciary responsibility as the legislature, you are approving the acquisitions of property that the state will own. Having said that, we clearly have more immediate concerns when we're trying to balance the state budget looking at the blue items here. And at the base of each of these columns, you can see the history up to the current biennium in the three columns to the left, and then two proposals for the 05-07 biennium to the right. I do not have a House or Senate co-chair proposal because, as I mentioned earlier, they have not communicated to me a particular approved budget. The only thing that I've heard from them is that one issue about the general fund for the Southern project. So I've not put that here, but instead I've put in the second to the most right column the amount that was in the governor's recommended budget, as it was printed and as it was put in the original bill, Senate Bill 5514, and then a revised governor's amount that represents, includes the changes that were presented in Phase 2 in Ways and Means, where Mr. McGee talked about there being some changes, and I haven't run this column by him, so I may not have gotten everything exactly right. I know he's in the process of looking at some projects, and I'm not sure whether they've been approved or not, but I believe this represents what was mentioned to be approved during Phase 2 when certain adjustments were presented. So the bottom blue represents the general fund, and if you look in 03-05, there's $11.5 million. That all went for the deferred maintenance capital repair issues. In 05-07, that amount was basically carried forward with a small inflationary increase, so it was up to about 11.8, and then there was also the $5.4 million for the Southern project that brought the total up to $17.2 million. Clearly, whatever goes in a general fund becomes a direct call upon the general fund that is in competition with everything else that you're trying to fund this session. So general fund, there's a direct general fund component. For the blue, the light blue amounts, these are the state paid bonds. And through the 03-05 biennium, so for those three columns to the left, the state paid bonds, what those numbers represent are the debt service costs on the Article 11G bonds and on the lottery bonds. And because these debt service costs come out of general fund and out of lottery funds, those costs are also in competition with everything else that needs to be funded by the state government. However, these are obligations. When they come to you, they are obligations of the state and essentially are taken off the top and paid first, and whatever is left is then available as resources to meet other needs available to the state. So you can see the amount that has been funded in the higher ed budget has varied considerably over this period of time, from only $25 million in 99-01 up to a rather generous $90 million in 01-03, and then back down this biennium, it dropped again to $32.5 million. The governor, in his initial budget, proposed $77 million of state-paid bonds, and given some recent additions and revisions to that, that number is now up to $108.3 million. So this would be higher than at any other biennium here for this period. And as I will be mentioning, the state paid bonds are going to include more now than just lottery and general fund. There's another source that's coming in there. So essentially the blue part is the part that affects the rest of the budget, state budget, directly, in the most direct manner. And you can see how that's changing. The way that the solid blue affects, again, is in the biennium that you're budgeting, that's money that has to be found in the general fund. For the light blue, the impact is shown on the next graph. So you could please switch over to the next graph. This shows, historically, the amount of debt service that we're paying, and this is broader than higher ed. Higher ed is continuing in the blue like it was in the earlier page, where we were looking at blue as the debt paid, as the debt paid, state paid debt. But here I've added, just to give a broader picture, the rest of post-secondary education, red being community colleges and yellow being OHSU. And this shows what the debt service is. And the debt service in a particular biennium, or the change in debt service, I should say, from one biennium to the next, is determined by what the state-paid bonds were in the prior biennium. So, for example, if you look at the 05-07 governor's recommended budget number, that's the one that's in the budget that you're being asked to approve, debt service totals $71 million. And this is basically not the result entirely of decisions that were made in prior biennia. Nothing that you would decide this time should change that number, or would be anticipated to change the $71 million number. Instead, if you approve more or approve less in state-paid bonds this biennium, that would affect the 07-09 number. Now, given the amount of state-paid bonds that are in the governor's revised budget, so this is the $108.3 million, if you approve that, then we project that the debt service next biennium would go from 71 to an estimated $101 million. This is clearly an estimate. We don't know exactly what the interest rate is going to be. And also, very often when you approve these bonds, they're not all issued immediately, especially if institutions are taking time to generate matching funds. It may take a couple biennia for the debt service to grow to the total amount. But this would be the impact in the 07-09 biennium of the both $108.3 million that are in the governor's revised budget for Department of Higher Education and the $91 million that are in the governor's budget for community colleges. There are no additional funds for debt for bonds for OHSU, so their amount is fixed. And these are pretty long-term. You know, they'll last for 15 biennia, what have you, when you approve these, because the bonds are typically of a 30-year term, unless they're a lottery where they're shorter.
Yes. What would be very helpful, I think, Mr. Bender, would be if, you know, if you were able to carry this graph out on a smaller thing, but, you know, as a bell curve to, obviously, if you didn't, if you funded the 2000, the capital expenditure as it is now, it'd be $101 million roughly next biennium. And then if we funded no more, it should stay at about 101, or as you pay it off, begin to drop back. If we could see that whole landscape out there, to payback would be interesting to see.
One question, Mr. Bender, going way back in your discussion.
Sure.
On the Article 11F bonds, the bonds that are for auxiliary activities, where they might be dependent upon actual money being paid for housing in terms of student housing costs, where it might be included within fees and might even be to some extent impacting tuition. In those types of bonds, is there a pretty significant due diligence sort of requirement in terms of determining, well, what percentage of the facility is going to actually be paid for by revenue that's generated from the facility? Like, I mean, if you build a housing unit, what percentage of the revenue is actually going to come from that, the building of that facility, in terms of what students are paying for housing?
Yes, I would say that there is that, to look at, to see the sources of revenue that would be available and to assure that the sources of revenue are sufficient in order to pay the anticipated debt service. If there is a situation where a facility is being used for more than one purpose, if a facility is being used jointly, I'm not sure if this is your question,
yeah,
let's say it's being used jointly for housing and jointly for some other purpose, we would generally try to see that there isn't one source is paying for more than its share.
Okay. I was just thinking that some of those calculations must become pretty complex, because I can think of some of the new facilities at Portland State that have actually commercial activities in their lowest floors and then housing in their upper floors. So
it's necessary in situations like that to look closely at this, and the department does much analysis of this to assure, for example, that bonds can still be issued on a tax-exempt basis.
Right.
There's limits to the amount of private activity that you can have in the facility. So there, as these facilities become more complex, you're correct, they're more complex to look at.
Where do we move now?
I think if we go to the next page, this is an actual listing of all of the facilities in the governor's revised budget by fund types. And you can see that some of them are listed in red. The facilities that are listed in red are those that, I guess it's pretty inconsistent, but those are the ones that either involve state paid bonds or general funds. So these facilities will create an obligation on the general fund either this biennium or this biennium and in the future. The items that are shown in black are entirely financed by university budgets, again, either through donations, et cetera, or from the Article 11 F1 bonds, which they pay out of their budgets.
For clarification here, there is no match required on the deferred maintenance, is there?
Yeah, well, it depends upon what the financing source is. We do use Article 11 G bonds to finance the first row there, where it says capital repair code compliance. That is also deferred maintenance, and you can see there that we are using $11.8 million in Article 11 G bonds, so there is a required match there, and the general fund is added to match that.
But you might be getting part of that match from some of those specialized purposes or specialized, I'm trying to think of an example of that.
The requirement, whether there's a requirement for a match, does not depend upon whether it's deferred maintenance or not.
Right.
It depends upon whether you're using Article 11 G bonds or not. You will see that if you look at the some of the columns are also indicated in red. These are the fund sources that have an impact on the state's general or lottery funds. And you can see the first column, the general fund monies, that's the direct impact. The next column, the Article 11 G bonds, has the general impact. Fund impact beginning in the biennium after issuance. So these would start having an impact in 07-09. The Article 11 F bonds are not shown in red because they don't have a general fund impact. The lottery bonds have a lottery fund impact. And here's the first of new funding mechanisms that are being proposed for this budget, and this will take a little bit of explanation because this is a new funding mechanism, and it's somewhat more complex in some respects than the other ones. And these are, the governor is proposing a number of projects that would use energy loans, state energy loans, in order to help finance part of the project. This program often goes by its acronym SELP. And what it stands for is the Small Scale Energy Loan Program that's administered by the Department of Energy. The way that the SELP program works is it provides low interest rate loans for energy conservation projects. So all of these items in that column, all of these facilities in that column, when you see a SELP number, what that means is that that particular project will save the institution money, energy, will conserve energy. They are all deferred maintenance projects. So these are facilities that are using a certain amount of energy now, and after the project is in place, they'll be able to save energy. And the department believes that the Department of Energy will certify that the projects will be available for loans for up to these amounts. Amounts are based on the expenditures relating to the energy savings. So if a project, for example, has a new heating system that is more efficient than the existing system in the building, the expenditures on the heating system can be used, are eligible for a SELP loan, whereas if there are certain components of the project that don't actually save energy, such as improving the interior walls or maybe changing the configuration of the inside of the building to update it, that may not save any energy, so those expenditures, the expenditures related to that part of the project, are not eligible for a SELP loan.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Two quick
questions.
One, Senator Walker. Mr. Bender, first, what is the source of the funds from the Department of Energy?
The Department of Energy, the source of funds, and I can again refer you back to page 2 now, or the second page here that's not numbered, where we talk about, about halfway down there, we talk about this program. The place where these funds come from is the state issues general obligation bonds to generate the funds that the Department of Energy then loans out. And it is a loan, just like the name indicates. Although they're general obligation bonds, they operate essentially as revenue bonds because the Department of Energy won't make a loan unless someone agrees to pay it back. And the payment stream is what's actually used to repay these loans, though the source of the funds is the general is state general obligation, and then the funds that are collected by the Department of Energy from the borrower are then transferred to whoever owns the bonds.
But the underlying purpose is that for reduced energy costs, they're actually repaying the bonds based upon their reduced energy costs.
The interest rates are low because these are general obligation bonds, and the governor is recommending a total of $27.9 million of these loans to help finance various deferred maintenance projects throughout the system.
And the question that I had about that, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bender, is you indicated the governor's proposing this, and now I know what the number is, 27.9. Does the governor have authority to do this, or is there a statutory authority somewhere floating around the building that we're trying to pass?
This bill in and of itself, if you pass it, will be sufficient to allow this to occur. The small-scale energy loan program already exists in statute.
Okay.
But this bill will approve the projects that you approve and the financing of those projects as you approve them.
Mr. Bender, it's also, isn't it being used by other agencies already also?
Yes,
I've seen it in some other budgets.
Okay, so I just needed to know, and that's been around a long while?
It's been around since 1980.
Oh. Hopefully we're using it wisely.
Senator Walker, you
I'm done now.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question was on the first line on the general fund obligation there. If I recall, that's a matching fund, and most of that is actually put up by local institutions or grants or gifts or whatever, so that $11.7 million is not necessarily an obligation of our general fund, but it shows up that way. Is that correct?
Actually, in this table, what I list as general fund is real general fund. It's not, well, the other isn't real, but the other is unreal. But this is the this is the regular general fund that comes from, you know, taxes and that sort of thing. So wherever you see an Article 11G bond number, so if you go down that column, the next one you see is Gilbert Hall at the University of Oregon. And you see, the governor's budget doesn't have any real, you know, direct general fund for that. So that means in this particular case, the University of Oregon would have to find $3.3 million in other funds to match that, which would presumably be gifts that were made specifically for that project. But it wouldn't have to be. I mean, they could use other revenues if you approve that.
But in this case, they've already raised it.
By the way, the reason why those three numbers for the University of Oregon in the Article 11G column are shown in blue instead of red was that I was just trying to differentiate between the governor's recommended budget and the governor's revised budget numbers. Those are figures that were added. Those were part of the reason for the difference. And another item that was added, which I forgot to put in blue, which I should have, I'm sorry, is the second to the last item on that first page. Apperson Hall at Oregon State University has $10 million in donations. That should be in blue as well. But these are some of the differences between the original governor's budget and the revised budget. Now, the other interesting thing about the State Energy Loan Program is, again, these are programs where the borrower has to pay the debt. So in this particular case, the person who's receiving the loan, the entity that's receiving the loan proceeds, is of course the Department of Higher Education. And the question is, well, how will they afford to pay that debt service? And the governor's budget proposes that the following. First of all, on this $27.9 million of loan proceeds, I'm estimating that the debt service on that will be about $3.9 million per biennium. That's shown in the second page of this table here, where I list the debt service by type of fund source. But the projects that are being financed from this $27.9 million in loans, that are going to have $3.9 million debt service, are projected to save the universities about $1.8 million per biennium in their energy costs through energy savings. So the proposal is that next biennium, which will be the first biennium that the state will have to pay the $3.9 million in debt service, that the state would only add $2.1 million general fund to the Department of Higher Education budget next biennium. So that would be an extra $2.1 million that would have to be added. And the remaining $1.8 million that gets you to the total, the institutions would not receive additional funding for that. Because they're not getting additional funding, that means that they have to absorb that debt service cost. But because that is equivalent to the amount of energy cost of their savings, they should be able to absorb that at no loss to themselves. They just won't be able to realize the energy savings. But there won't be an additional cost because now that will replace what they're paying for energy to help meet the debt service. And presumably higher ed would have to adjust their RAM model and have an adjustment by campus, because this would be on a campus-by-campus basis, how much they are saving in terms of energy costs. So this is a method of, again, the state would not have to pay the full amount of debt service on these bonds as an additional cost, but would incorporate actual cost reductions at the campuses as a means of financing a portion of this.
Mr. Bender, this is a different subject than what we have before us here today, but the energy loans, are those available under the Department of Energy to all public agencies or just state public agencies?
I am not. I believe when I was looking at the statute, it looked like all public, but I will get a confirmation of that. I've not really worked with this program very much.
The reason I bring it up is because I've heard nothing in discussions on the community colleges in terms of their capital program about the use of that potential mechanism, which in some of their cases might seem applicable given what they're planning to rebuild. Or
it could potentially, there may be options there. Finally, there is another source of funding in the proposed budget to help address capital construction needs, and that is the use of the Business Energy Tax Credit, which is another program that is administered by the Department of Energy, in this case also with the Department of Revenue. And the way the Business Energy Tax Credit works is it's a tax credit established in statute that allows businesses a credit against their Oregon income taxes when they make qualified energy conservation expenditures. So the Department of Energy certifies that expenditures are being made which are eligible for a credit under the law, and then the business is eligible to take that credit over a five-year period, and the credit totals 35% of the eligible expenditures. So if you have $100,000 in eligible expenditures, there'll be $35,000 in tax credit available over a five-year period. The credit is also made available, though, to to entities that don't have an Oregon income tax liability, because a tax credit only works if you have to pay tax. The Oregon University System does not pay Oregon income tax. They're a state agency. So a state agency or a nonprofit or even a for-profit business that isn't earning enough to pay enough in tax to use the credit can make use of a pass-through provision in the Betsy. And under the pass-through provision, what happens is the person who makes the expenditures can essentially sell their tax credit at a discount to a for-profit business that has sufficient tax liability to use the credit. Generally, what would happen is the credit, as I mentioned, is equal to 35% of eligible expenditures. So if there's $100,000 in eligible expenditures, there's a $35,000 credit that's available. Because Oregon University System wouldn't have to pay the taxes in the first place, the value of that credit to them is zero. But under the pass-through program, they can work to transfer that credit under law to a for-profit business. And typically the for-profit business will pay about 25.5%. So for the $100,000 in expenditures, they would essentially pay $25,500 for the right to claim $35,000 in tax and credit against their taxes over the next 5 years.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bender, can you provide an existing example of how this works?
This would be work. I don't have a specific example that I'm aware of, but this would be available for any public institution that is eligible, that makes qualifying conservation expenditures. It would be available to a nonprofit who would not be required to pay Oregon income tax, or it would be available to a regular for-profit business that simply is perhaps operating at a loss and therefore has no tax liability.
Again, just seeking clarity, what you're describing is an existing program.
Correct.
And I'm seeking examples of how the program has been implemented.
I'm not sure that this program actually has never been used in OUS before. Has this program been used in the Oregon University System?
Why don't you come forward and identify yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hi, Bob Simonton, Director of Capital Instruction for the Oregon University System. On our Lewis Business Center at the University of Oregon, we did use a small business energy tax credit for the solar panels that we installed on the building. I'm trying to remember the details of that. It was roughly $1 million part of the larger Lewis Business Center project, which qualified for $280,000 worth of funds from local businesses. And in turn, the local business could take $350,000 in tax credits over 5 years. So there's a little incentive. It's essentially the net present value of that tax break is what they're paying, writing a check towards the project. So we would have Oregon businesses writing a check to the university for $280,000.
And the Mr. Chair, the project that you're describing took place when? If this is a project that has been completed?
Yes, it was approved in the I believe it was the 0103 session. Recently constructed and finished. And a component of that project was to add photovoltaic arrays to generate electricity. We received some other grant funds from the local utility provider, but it was a way to help us provide that equipment. Whereas the without that Betsy tax credit, the photovoltaic arrays would not have been able to have been afforded in the budget.
Well, it's helpful, Mr. Chair, to understand that there is a precedent for using the program that has been described. That's helpful to me. Thank you.
Mr. Bender, this is a state tax credit, correct?
Correct.
So if people were interested in seeing how much this was utilized, if they looked at the tax expenditure budget, it should be one of the pages listed there.
Yes.
So, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Now where do we go?
Well, I just wanted to mention that in the governor's recommended budget, as it was originally submitted, there's $5 million in business energy tax credits that would be available to help build a new energy plant at Oregon State University, which you may know is in serious need of upgrade at this point. And the impact of that, there is a general fund impact of this because these are credits that people will be using to reduce general fund collections. And the timing of this is very uncertain because it's not clear exactly what the 2007-09 impact would be. But the first 2 years impact that people would be using this credit would be about $1.4 million impact on the general fund. That doesn't show up in any of these expenditure sides, but that is a cost of is financing the project.
That's the new steam plant?
Yes, that is. Mm-hmm. And that's why in that particular row, the $43 million in the second to the right column is in red, because part of that, $5 million, not all of it, but $5 million of that is business energy tax credit that would have a general fund impact. So this is a list of the facilities that are financed or are proposed by the governor's revised budget. The rest of the presentation that I've prepared is to talk a little bit about the deferred maintenance, the way that the budget addresses deferred maintenance, and how both the system and the governor combined determined which projects to bring forward to you at this time. But that's all shown in this chart on the last page, which I... is rather complicated, and I won't be going through all of it. But I just wanted to identify here that the Oregon University system ranked its deferred maintenance request into five different tiers, starting with Tier 1, which was their highest priority, down to Tier 5, which was their lowest priority. I believe that in Tier 5, for example, all of those facilities, even though they might have very extensive, some of them might have extensive deferred maintenance needs, they are all administrative buildings, and they don't directly serve students or faculty
Benders,
researchers.
Some of these seem to be pretty self-explanatory, but is CRV, that's current replacement value.
Correct.
Okay.
The FCI, the percentage term on the... left-hand column, the higher that number is, the worse shape that facility is in, because that represents basically the cost of repairing it as a percent of the cost of replacing it. So if something has a very high
number...
There
are sometimes different issues between the cost of replacement and or repairing and replacement other than just cost.
What does FCI stand for?
Index. It's some kind of facility condition index. Thank you, Mr. Simon.
Facility condition index.
See if we got somebody really.
Some of these, for example, in Tier 2, OSU Education Hall, 92%. That's a facility that's not very good shape at all. Whereas the central heating plant at Southern Oregon University that's up in Tier 1 is in much better shape. Now, the reason why these were developed in tiers, before I continue, let me mention that what the governor did was included the projects in Tiers 1 and 2. So Tiers 1 and 2 made it into the governor's budget. Tiers 3, 4, and 5 did not.
Okay. But he included Snell Hall at...
Yes.
He did. Okay. So we only have two in Tier 3.
Oh, in Tier 3, there are only two in Tier 3, correct?
Right.
Yes.
I think we had some discussion before that kind of gave the impression that Snow Hollow was Tier 3 in a previous meeting.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't... Is it... What? Inlow Hall.
Okay. Inlow.
Oh, Inlow Hall. Oh, that's because of the remains issue. Okay, that's been moved up to Tier 3.
Oh, okay. That's where that's coming from.
This one went up to Tier
3? It's the last one that's listed before the total. It's in Tier 5, Inlow Hall at Eastern Oregon University.
There's a general expectation, though, is there not, that some of these facilities in your index, that, you know, the longer that you wait, the higher that number is going to be in terms of deferred maintenance. And if you put off replacing a roof 5 or 10 years longer, it's going to cost you quite a bit more to do all the work that's going to be necessary at that stage. So...
The way that these projects are ranked have a bias, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, but just have a favor those projects that can achieve energy savings in their deferred maintenance issues. So even though a project may have a very high need for repair, it may be the case that only a small proportion of the total costs really help to save energy. Because of the funding mechanism that whereby the institutions are trying to realize actual cost savings in order to help finance these projects, those projects that realize cost savings in the form of energy savings tend to be ranked in the higher tiers. What we see here is, if, for example, if we look at Tier 1, all of these are facilities that create energy. So when you start renovating them and dealing with deferred maintenance issues for an energy-producing facility, you end up saving a lot of energy or being able to produce more energy for the same cost. So those entities are in Tier 1. In Tier 2, you have three facilities that don't produce energy at all, but that do also have some energy savings that would be realized if the deferred maintenance issues were addressed.
And so, Mr. Chair, is that how Inlow Hall moved up?
No.
No, Inlow was due to the other issue that you presented, right?
Yes, we heard testimony that it was discovered that Inlow Hall has specific renovation needs because human remains have been found in the facility that need to be reburied.
Below the facility. In the facility?
I think in the facility. In the facility. Or the crawl space or something.
Oh, okay. I'm not
in the foundation.
Okay.
I think there was some joke about that the founders are the foundation of the building now or something like that. I remember that discussion. That's really
a ghost story.
And there's got to be a ghost story.
It's a paranormal center.
But it's only made it up to Tier 3. We don't think it's that important.
We'll wait for the lawsuit.
I think I need to go back and look at the record of that meeting.
Okay.
Yeah, that was early on in the...
I don't recall
year.
The discussion.
I'll try to find that for you, Senator Berman.
I can help locate that.
Okay. If you'd give me a date, I might be able to find it. But you know the way these notebooks breed.
I had a question, actually, on Tier 3, if you want to come forward. The two projects that are not in the governor's recommended revisions at this time, but... Hampton and Lincoln Hall that are ranked in their FCI at 79 and 72. What does those numbers really mean? Is that like when something's ranked that high, is it like it's habitable but it's 10%? Or
it means there's not a lot of good in those buildings, correct?
Right.
But most of the subsystems, the roofing, the heating, the electrical are way past their expected life and are in need of replacement.
Okay.
But for instance, in a Tier 1, when you had the education hall at OSU moved to 92%, does that start to put into question whether or not you can still utilize the facility? I mean, is there a point at which deferred maintenance is at such a state that the whether or not you can continue to hold classes in it might be in question?
Mr. Chair, I believe if we even add the seismic component to it, that the facility condition index would be over 100%. So there's more wrong with it than what it's worth. But this is one of the first buildings on the Oregon State campus. So it has some historic value, minus falling, I believe, top there. And this is the building that's wrapped in chain link fence that's holding it together.
Okay. Sort of like duct tape?
Industrial duct tape kind of thing.
Yeah. Senator Whitson?
Chair Devlin, while Mr. Symington's up here, there's a couple of things I wanted to address, and I don't know if you can do this off the top of your head or approximate or whatever, but and the questions are based on what's the value of doing it now as opposed to waiting. And if you're assuming that interest rates are going up, amortized over 20 or 30 years, take your choice, what's the difference in a 1% change in interest rate for $100 million?
Address the first question about waiting. Many of these buildings have been waiting for many, many years, and they're way past. And we get to a point where when things fail, they have a tendency to do harm to other things that may still be good in a building, and I can give examples. Lincoln Hall, we have a sidewalk that's failing, and water leaks into the sidewalk, and underneath that sidewalk is the electrical switchgear for the building. So when that sidewalk failed, water leaked into the switchgear and turned on a switch, which turned on a pump and flooded another building, which did about $300,000 worth of damage.
Certainly. And a leaking roof does the building.
And same thing with the leaking roofs. So so that's the cost of waiting. Things will eventually fail. It's not a question if they fail.
That's really not what the question was aimed at. The question was aimed at if we do it now as opposed to waiting, if we do it now at a 5% interest rate instead of waiting a year or 2 years and doing it at a 6 or 6.5% interest rate, amortized over 20 or 30 years, what is the savings on $100 million?
I can get that. $600 million is the current backlog of projects, so the longer you wait and the higher the interest rate, it ramps up fairly quick.
I guess my point is I'm trying to get some quantification on the urgency of doing it now while we have low interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And while the projected building costs are they're not particularly low right now, but the projected interest building costs are going to go up also.
Yes. If we could kind of get some
sense of the savings of doing it now as opposed to waiting for 2 or 4 years and what the cost of that same project might be then, notwithstanding the amount of damage that might be done within the building by not doing it now.
Senator Whitson, would it be fair to say that if you could come back with something to us that's saying what the cost is in terms of the cost of debt service at various levels of increases and what we might have to pay for a general obligation bond, and also what we anticipate, or we probably already forecast this, what we anticipate to be the increasing cost of construction over the next several years. I can remember a time at which actually when the economy was very booming, when you couldn't actually get you would send out a bid, and if you could get one or two contractors that would even bid on it, you were lucky.
Mm-hmm.
At that point.
And then 1981 came along.
So if we could get that, that'd be helpful
to provide that. Yes.
Did you have a question?
Yes.
I did. I guess this is for Steve. Is in all these calculations, it's the benefit of the income tax from these new projects. Is that figured into the mix in anywhere?
No. And I don't know exactly what you would include in that. Would that be the wages of the people who are
working
on the
project? I mean, like, so the governor's recommended budget for 205, 207, you have $300 million. I mean, I know there's debt service and things like that involved, but and say you paid a 9% tax on it, that would be $27 million or something like that. But, I mean, is there any way to quantify that?
No, we don't. We never do. We actually do not do that as a part of our fiscal analysis. I mean, I can work with you to see if there's one, something to do, some way to look at that particular question, but we do not include that as a, you know, a fiscal analysis of state incurring debt.
There would be some impact, though, as paying some of this money out for wages, people have been paying taxes.
Yes, there would be a number of impacts. There would be, you know, the impacts would actually be fairly complex if you started going into these second-order impacts, including the fact that there would be less funds available to the state government in future biennia because of the debt service, and that may also have impacts on, work their way through to impacts on tax collections. You know, so it can be quite complex.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Mr. Bender, did you have anything additional?
Not really. I mean, I was going to talk a little bit about some of the lottery funds and SELP funds in the budget, but I think unless there's a question,
okay,
it's probably...
Okay.
I do have one more question. Just if you are you about ready to finish up here?
No, we have a few minutes. Senator Nelson, please.
So just checking, you talked earlier about the community college funds and they split the budget. One has a house split out the community college budget and... Has a community college budget, capital construction budget, been scheduled for this committee?
No, it has not been scheduled for this committee. I do understand the reasoning behind splitting the capital for OUS and the capital for the community colleges. But no decision has been made there. In terms of one of the difficulties, and I don't know, we are now sending Senate bills over to the House on budgets for agencies, and they are sending House bills over to us on the same agencies, or they could make the counterstatement that we're doing. But sooner or later, we'll be on the same bill, and one of the bills that's causing a little bit of difficulty trying to figure out whether or not you'd use it is they did send over a K-12 budget, but they included the community college operating budget in that budget. So do you do both, or do you pick one and use another vehicle, or... So, but I'm hoping that actually we get some more good, solid discussion of the capital programs in OUS and in community colleges before the committee, because I'm hoping that this simply doesn't become just a last-minute leadership discussion in the closing days of the session, and then whatever decision that's made is pretty well thought out. So, thank you. Anything additional? Next week we will be actually potentially, and I have to say potentially, we may be doing the Department of Ed. So that's about all that I can think of that might be ready for next week at this point. With that, I will close the work session on SB 5526. I want to thank everyone for coming here, even though we weren't making any decisions today. And I will close the committee until next Monday at 3 o'clock.